For organizations that have never had a penetration test, I think it's very eye-opening for them. In fact, those organizations who have had repeated penetration tests know that there are going to be things that have been missed. And that's where the third party can come in and say, you know, things were pretty good, but this was missing. And as a result of that, that one or two or 10 missing security patches or security configuration settings, we were able to take over the whole domain. Yeah. So yeah, I think it is a big surprise. But you know, usually people say, we're glad you found it and not the real bad guys.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, where we talk to the people who keep the internet safe. These industry experts share their innovative cyber defense technologies, vital insights into threats, and predictions for the future of cybersecurity. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. This podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for SecOps where everything is built API first. Scale with confidence as your business grows. Start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. My guest today is Terry Bradley, founder and president of Mile High Cyber and a cybersecurity professional with decades of experience in offensive and defensive security. Terry began his career as a hacker for the NSA and is also a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. Today, he helps mid-sized businesses identify and fix security vulnerabilities through penetration testing, cybersecurity risk assessments, and security consulting. Through his firm, Mile High Cyber, Terry works with organizations that may rely on small IT teams or managed service providers, but need deeper cybersecurity expertise to uncover weaknesses before attackers do. In this conversation, we'll talk about penetration testing, how real attackers think, and what businesses should be doing to stay ahead of cyber threats. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today, Terry. It's a real honor to have you.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
So the first thing I'm always interested in learning from people is like how they became interested in technology and how that kind of developed into a career in cybersecurity.
You know, I was thinking about this yesterday. I was driving somewhere and somehow I got thinking about the olden days of computers. And I remember in elementary school, a friend of mine and I had figured out that if you hit Control C, you can stop most programs. This was a while ago. And so, you know, we got interested in going to different places and we went to the local arboretum and they had some sort of a program running about nature. And of course, you know, we found the keyboard and hit Control C and started looking at the basic program. And I was just fascinated with technology, even from an early age. Got a Commodore 64 when I was in middle school or junior high, and just always loved computers and saw computers as sort of like a foreign language. If you could tell the computer what you wanted and how, if you told it in a way that the computer understood, it was really more like talking to a person than programming to me.
All right, and so that's your interest. How did it then evolve into cybersecurity? Did you start in IT or the help desk or anything like that and move through, or did you go to school for computer science?
Well, I went to the U.S. Air Force Academy, and I had thought that computer science would be a great career field. Unfortunately, I'd never encountered this thing called calculus. And when I got into Calc 2, I was completely baffled and was really struggling. And it was about that time that I went to the computer science department to tell them that I wanted to major in computer science. And they said, great, we'd love to have you just, you know, sign up for Calc 3 and linear algebra. And I'm like, whoa, stop. I'm not even passing Calc 2 right now. You know, I will probably get through it somehow, but I said, I don't know what Calc 3 is all about. It's probably not for me.
Yeah.
So I sort of diverted and went over to the English department because they had the deal where, you know, no more math classes after your core requirements. And so I became an English major, minor, and I thought, well, I'm going to be a pilot in the Air Force, so I won't need all that computer stuff anyways. As it turned out, I was not a pilot in the Air Force. The Cold War was ending, and I went into intelligence. And that's where I sort of rejoined with IT and cyber. And that's kind of my backdoor entry into cybersecurity was working in the intelligence community and eventually for NSA.
Well, that's very cool. It's funny you mentioned Calc 2. Here we had the 100 level calc and then the multivariant calculus the second year, which I had to take twice. Yeah, and I barely got through it. It was the hardest thing ever. And then how many times I've used it in my career? Zero. You know, so I don't know why they do that to folks. I think we lose a lot of like very talented technologists because the math requirements are so stringent. So, and now you're running your own show, Mile High Cyber, and you're consulting with businesses. Penetration testing seems to be like one of the core services that you're offering. Maybe for our listeners who might not be super familiar, can you walk us through at a high level what that is, and then we can kind of dig in a little?
Sure. So at a very high level, penetration testing is getting engaged to be to play the role of an ethical hacker. So we try to do the same sort of tests that cyber criminals and cyber threat actors would do to break into an organization and steal their data. The goal here is to find security flaws that need to be fixed and hopefully communicate them in a way that our customers can understand and fix them before they actually get hacked. And so that's kind of the most common project that we get hired for is a network penetration test, but we have a lot of other flavors that are related to that: web application, pen tests, penetration tests that include social engineering. So sending in either phishing emails or making phone calls. Or this week, the flavor of the week seems to be Teams phishing. Mm. Hackers are increasingly using Microsoft Teams to send in messages to employees and get them to do things that damage the organization.
And I think you touched on my next question a little there, where I was going to ask the difference between a vulnerability scan and a penetration test. And it's sort of that human element, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think penetration testing in theory should go a little bit deeper than a vulnerability assessment or vulnerability scan. When you do the vulnerability scan or assessment, you're trying to catalog all of the problems. And usually that includes telling you how to fix it as well. The penetration test goes a little bit deeper, and maybe because it goes deeper, it's a little bit less broad. So maybe you're not trying to find every single vulnerability, but just the most serious security risks. And then once you've identified those risks, the penetration test includes exploitation normally, where you actually, try to break in with those security flaws and pull that thread and say, okay, using the security flaw, this is what we're able to get access to, and this is what it means for the business.
And when engaging with a new client, how do you like determine the scope of the penetration testing? Is it really a matter of budget or the like perceived risk that organization's facing based on what industry they're in?
Normally, we do some sort of a scoping exercise, which involves a questionnaire. Maybe we can collect the information over the initial call if it's not too much information or too technical, but usually it's a function of how much stuff they have. If someone were to say, how much does it cost to paint a house? You would say, well, how big is the house?
Yeah, right.
And how much paint do you want? And what kind of paint do you want? So, we're trying to assess how much time it's going to take to adequately test the organization or the business, how many different things we're going to have to test. If it's an external only penetration test, so no access to the internal network granted, we're trying to figure out how many internet facing systems we need to test to adequately test the security of the organization.
Is there any open source tools that you guys use that our listeners might want to go check out to play with?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the majority of the tools that we use are free and open source. So our kind of baseline platform is Kali Linux. Been around for many years, evolved from Backtrack and probably something before that. And it's an open source Linux distribution. It has, I'm guessing 1,000 different penetration test tools built into it. And there are some that we use, very frequently, and then others are, more niche and we may never actually use those tools. But we use the open source Linux penetration testing tools. And then we have a variety of other specialized software packages, some of which we have to pay for, that allow us to do our penetration testing.
Very cool. Are there any common vulnerabilities that you see in corporate environments? Like what's the most common thing you encounter when you're doing a penetration test?
I would say probably the most common thing that we see organizations missing in 2026 is still multi-factor authentication.
Yes.
Whether that's, you know, on internal systems that are important and should really have MFA, or external systems that, you know, somehow have not gotten the memo that MFA is important. So a lot of organizations will roll out policies or some sort of security control to enforce MFA, but there's always some systems that somehow, you know, evade capture and are missing MFA. Things like copier accounts or scanner accounts. Those are more difficult to configure with MFA. And so a lot of times we're able to get access to those even from the internet, and they're missing MFA. So that's a big one. On the internal networks, there's a lot of security configuration flaws associated with Active Directory. Especially the on-prem Active Directory domain controllers, there are a lot of security settings that just are not turned on by default. Microsoft wants to make it easy to get up and running and to keep things working. And unfortunately, the default security permission of most domain controllers is not very good. And our penetration testers take advantage of that and escalate privileges and move throughout the organization.
Yeah, we talk about that in the cloud a lot, actually. Like, all these really great tools are meant to be really easy to set up and get running, but that doesn't mean you're done. You have to go read the doc and make sure you have all the security configurations turned on. Patch management's one we talk about a lot on the show. Do you see that as an issue in corporate environments? I know it's one of those things that, unless you have dedicated security personnel, that often gets left by the wayside.
Yeah, I think there is a perception, like at the layman level, that if I need a patch, someone's going to tell me. You know, Chrome is very good about letting you know there's an update. And of course, Windows update is always telling you it's time to reboot, and same with a Macintosh. But across the large enterprise, there are a lot of security updates, a lot of software updates that just never, you know, reach the user's attention. And the more systems you have, the harder it is to keep everything up to date with software. And so Microsoft has their own built-in tools to update operating systems and office suites and different applications. But we find that those Microsoft tools are either difficult to use or not fully effective. I'm sure someone who's, you know, very skilled and trained in using them could do a great job with the built-in Microsoft tools. But we just find a lot of missing updates, a lot of missing patches, except for, you know, organizations that have a more modern third-party product that better at finding all of those missing patches.
Is it often a surprise for companies that hire you to do a penetration testing to learn how much vulnerability they actually have to hackers?
Yes. For organizations that have never had a penetration test, I think it's very eye-opening for them. Either they thought or they've been told that their IT team had everything under control. And, you know, you want to think the best of people and not be suspicious. But in fact, those organizations who have had repeated penetration tests know that there are going to be things that have been missed. And that's where the third party can come in and say, you know, things were pretty good, but this was missing. And as a result of that one or two or 10 missing security patches or security configuration settings, we were able to take over the whole domain.
No.
So yeah, I think it is a big surprise. But you know, usually people say, we're glad you found it and not the real bad guys.
Yeah. And in those successes that you have as the red teamer, the attacker, do you see phishing attacks or technical exploits being more successful in penetrating the organization?
You know, we only get very small samples of anecdotal evidence on what's actually working. You know, we do hear from customers when they have a security breach. We always want to know, how did that happen? Because we want to make sure that our testing is thorough and comprehensive, that we're adding new tests to our methodology that reflect what the attackers are really doing. But the biggest source that we follow very closely are the big data breach reports. So every year, Verizon puts out what they call the data breach incident report, your investigative report, the DIBR. We read that, you know, very carefully to make sure that we're understanding what real world threat actors are doing in real world breaches. Google Mandiant just put out their annual MTrends report. Was just poring over that this morning. And then, of course, the FBI cybercrime report comes out once a year, and they're seeing customers who have suffered some sort of financial loss. But all of these, and I think CrowdStrike does one as well, all of these, though, are about a year behind. Mm-hmm. And so certainly we want to make sure that we're keeping up with what happened in the previous year. But, you know, we rely also on hearing from customers out there when they do suffer a more recent data breach. We want to know, you know, how that happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just recently we've had a spate of customers that have been attacked through Teams messages. And so, you know, that's something that we're adding to our methodology to make sure that we're testing to see that customers are not accepting Teams messages from external to their organization.
Yeah, it's like they find the niche that works, and then everybody rushes in, and the defenders rush in, and they've patched a hole, and then they find another hole, and, you know, the cat and mouse game continues, right?
It is, yeah.
One thing that I think I've noticed over the last year or two doing the podcast is how we seem to have gone from, you know, threat actors going after very large organizations to a bigger focus on, you know, small mid-market companies, business email compromise. Why do you think attackers are starting to switch their focus back down market, as it were?
Well, I think there's probably a couple of reasons. One is those organizations are often not very well defended. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're by and large kind of easy pickings. And related to that, automation and, you know, dare I even say AI, is allowing attackers to scale in ways that they can go, you know, scoop up some of these smaller organizations. Maybe they're smaller jackpots, but there's still a lot of them out there. And so if you have a scalable process that's largely automated, you can really, you know, get a lot of money as a cyber criminal going after small mm-hmm. mid-tier companies. So that's why I think it is, you know, the bigger organizations are investing and you know, maybe they're harder targets. They're not impossible, but attackers have limited resources. We always, you always hear people say, well, the attackers have as much time as it takes, or the attackers have, you know, no constraints like we do for cybersecurity budget, but that's not true. The attackers really do have limited resources in terms of time and energy and the number of people that they have. Mm-hmm. So they have to optimize toward where can we make the most money. And I think right now, mid-market and smaller businesses, maybe not the really, really small, but you know, the bigger end of small and mid-market is where there's a lot of opportunity to commit crime and collect money.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of cryptocurrency, mostly because I think it's really made the business of cybercrime so accessible to so many people. Like, I couldn't imagine the world we live in now if you had to drop a bag of money off somewhere. You know, I just don't think it would work the same way.
Yeah, well, I mean, cryptocurrency has definitely enabled cybercrime. You know, that doesn't mean that it's responsible for mm-hmm. it, but it has certainly facilitated it and accelerated it in ways that probably the creators never envisioned.
For sure. Yeah, no, I think they definitely had high ideals when they came up with the technology. It just, you know, this is how things fall apart.
Hey, it's Nicole from the Lima Charlie marketing team. Many security teams deal with tool sprawl. Dozens of different solutions that create gaps in visibility and slow down response times. Our SecOps Cloud platform consolidates your security stack into a unified platform where everything works together. Lima Charlie gives you comprehensive endpoint visibility and automated response capabilities in milliseconds instead of minutes, so you can stop threats before they spread across your environment. Try our scalable infrastructure for your security services for free at limacharlie.io.
Outside of like MFA on everything, which I'm a huge advocate for, YubiKeys or hardware keys if you can afford them, What's something that a company could do tomorrow to improve its security posture? What's some low-hanging fruit for folks to think about?
I think one of the things I always tell people, and this goes for consumers as well, is turn on all the alerting. You know, there's so much that you can alert on that's just, you know, not enabled by default. So turn on alerting. You know, for a consumer, it's helpful to know whenever a transaction takes place. Maybe you're tired of push notifications or text messages, but I want to know every time my credit card's used. Because every once in a while, I look at a charge and I say, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
This happened to us on vacation last year. Had a $1,700 charge come through in the credit. And, you know, if we had waited 30 days until we got the statement in the mail and went through and crossed off all the things, you know, those attackers would have been long gone. It would have been hard to recover the money, harder than it was than when we saw it come through. And my wife looked at me and said, hey, did you make a $1,700 charge? I'm like, not that I know of. And, you know, we were able to get on it more quickly. And so I think that also applies in cyber security and data breaches. Turn on all the alerting. There are, of course, you know, lots of ways now that you can automate the review of those logs and eliminate many of them. But if you're not even collecting that data to begin with, you're missing out. So I always tell people, turn on all alerting and then figure out, okay, how do you sort through it and analyze it and check it. But even if you never looked at it, at least it's a great source of information to go back and figure out what happened.
For sure. Yeah. Log all the things if you can. So as far as like we all understand, I think in security that eventually you're going to get breached, or at least you should plan to eventually get breached. And then we have what's called an incident response plan. What kind of stuff should that entail for like a small, medium sized business who doesn't have like a full security team? Like, how do they deal with it when they wake up and find out they've been compromised?
Yeah. So, I mean, having the plan is step one. In many organizations, I might even would be willing to say most businesses don't have an incident response plan. And so having one is the first step. And probably the first thing that it needs to have is who are you going to call? You know, there are a lot of things that you can handle. You can, you know, fix yourself. You can give to your IT team, but identify who are you going to call once it gets past you. And for a small business, for a mid-market company, that might be a pretty low threshold. That might happen, you know, very quickly. So identify who are you going to call. Just saw a billboard the other day that said, know where your ER is before you need it. And I thought that's a great analogy for cybersecurity. You better know who your incident response provider is before you need them. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we get calls from time to time. We don't really do incident response. It's not our specialty. But we'll get calls from someone who says, hey, we've had a data breach, or we've had a ransomware incident. We're looking for help. And I just think, boy, you're kind of late in the game.
Yeah.
If you're calling people you've never even spoken to before, like me,
mm-hmm.
Usually we can refer them off to a really good provider.
But it's a couple days before anybody's in there, even in a good case, right?
Well, yeah, because, you know, incident response team, they want to get access to your endpoint detection and response and all the logging that you've been doing, of course. And, you know, in most of those cases, there is no EDR and there is no logging. And so now there's a process of installing endpoint agents on all the systems so that you can do data collection. Meanwhile, you know, the bad guys are making off with your data or, you know.
None of it gets cheaper.
Yeah, it's like imagining that you're going to negotiate a price as you know, being rolled into the ER.
Yeah, right.
Who's on duty tonight? You know, well, where did they go to med school? You know, how much is this going to cost me? I mean, at the point that you're being rolled into the ER, you've lost all bargaining power. And so the first thing incident response plan needs to have is okay, who are we going to call? You know, do we have a relationship with them? Have we pre-negotiated rates? Have we, you know, thought about at least that? And then you start to go down the list of things that are also important, like the call tree, who's going to be alerted if there's a serious security incident. I think most organizations probably think this is an IT problem. So, you know, it's going to be a list of everyone on the IT team. for a serious data breach, it's an organizational issue. You're going to need
the CEO.
The CEO, you know, the board's going to have to be notified if it's a bigger organization. You're going to want your communications specialist involved early on. Most organizations will try to keep it quiet, but eventually, if it's a serious security incident, you're going to have to do something that's going to tip people off that there's a problem. And so you want your communications team ready to say things that are truthful, but also things that are not going to cause a general panic among your customers or constituency. You don't want to lie, but you also don't want to freak people out.
And then, if you're a publicly traded company, you have 4 days to make an official press release, right?
There's the next person on your list is your general counsel or legal counsel to make sure that, you know, you're doing things, you're meeting your compliance requirements, you're not breaking the law in any way. And so, you know, you've got to have the call tree of all the people that are going to be on your incident response team and, you know, thresholds for how serious does the security incident have to be before we convene this team. Some things, you know, you may not need to convene the whole team and circle the wagons. You can wipe a system, you can reset a password. But, you know, there are some things that are going to be more serious in a multi-hour, multi-day event. And so you need a complete list of who's going to be called in and what each person's role is, which kind of leads you to the point of thinking, hey, if it's really that complicated, we should probably practice this, you know, at least a walkthrough of, you know, even if we don't like work on an actual scenario, just from time to time, convene the team, you know, make sure the call tree is complete. And then if you really want to, you know, get good at this, then you probably need to practice it periodically and work through different scenarios. What if we had a ransomware? What if we had a business email compromise? What if a third party compromised all of our sensitive data? You know, how do we handle this, and what's that going to look like?
You mentioned it a little earlier, AI, kind of tongue in cheek. Are you seeing that in the breaches? Like, is it having an impact on cybersecurity already, would you say?
Yeah, I don't know that we've seen it among our customer set. But I don't know that we would recognize it either. You know, I mentioned those reports that we read every year. Microsoft just put out a report within the last few months about threat actor use of AI. And Microsoft is saying that threat actors are using it to speed up research and reconnaissance. They're using it to scale infrastructure. They're using it to create more convincing phishing lures. And so I think, you know, we're seeing it, we're just not really sure, you know, how much AI is being used.
Mm-hmm.
So as we think about our processes, we want to try to emulate the threat actors as much as we can, where we can, if it's legal to do it. And so one of the things that we're trying to figure out is how do we integrate AI in a way that doesn't, you know, degrade the quality of our current testing process, but does allow us to scale and gain some efficiency so that we can, you know, be a more realistic threat to our customers who want us to play that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, for sure, I think the phishing email, the quality has been better. I haven't got one with bad English for some time now. On the high end, I think we are seeing it being used to, you know, write malware. We're seeing like new malware written in Rust and Go and these languages we've never seen before. And I think it's partially driven by how easy it is to write code now.
Yeah, I want the threat actors out there to start tagging their malware. We know that this was generated by AI.
Not the organic malware of days of old, right?
Yeah. So, I do really believe that they're using it, not because their CEO told them they had to. It's just giving them efficiency gains. And, you know, we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah, I think definitely the breadth of people able to participate on both sides of the line now are wider because of AI and just a matter of keeping up with what's happening. Are there trends? You mentioned Microsoft Teams. I think we've covered a news article on that recently on the show. Are there any other trends in cybersecurity that business leaders should be paying attention to right now?
I think we're going to see AppSec heat up a lot. I mean, it's already hot, but,
right.
You know, 9 out of 10 requests we get for a penetration test are network pen tests because someone told them or someone made them go get a penetration test. I don't think there's a large awareness of how vulnerable applications are, and that the network pen test is not necessarily going to catch the application level security flaws that are exposing our organization. So as we see more and more vibe coding and AI assisted coding, you know, not all of those developers are being careful and doing security checks or even asking Claude code to be secure. Like here's a tip, you know, after Claude writes that code, say, hey, why don't you do a security review? Obviously, oh, I found 5 critical errors. And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, go ahead and fix those first. So I think as we see more and more AI-assisted and automated applications rolling out, there's going to be more security breaches related to those applications. And then people will get a general awareness of, okay, I also need to have an application pen test, especially for my internet-facing applications. You know, some regulations already include that. FDA is mandating that registered medical devices have twice a year penetration testing. And so some of those medical devices are websites, they're web apps. And we have customers that come to us to get, you know, twice a year pen testing of their apps because they're now required to. But I think a lot of business leaders are not aware. They thought, well, we had a pen test, so didn't that take care of it? And, or, you know, we put in the multi-factor authentication. Doesn't that protect us?
Mm-hmm. I can see how they'd be skeptical too. If you've never been breached, it just looks like an expense, but you realize it's an ounce of sweat will save a liter of blood. I think that's very true with your cyber preparedness as well. So for somebody starting in cybersecurity right now, you know, very different world than I think when either of us first started, would you have any recommendations of the types of skills they'd want to develop, where they'd start, how they'd get going? It's very competitive now.
It is. And I speak with a lot of people who have gotten a certification or they're in the process of getting some sort of certificate from a university or training program. And they've been told, you know, if you get this certification or this certificate, you know, it's going to unlock the key to these high paying jobs. And I'm not down on education in any way, but I think, you know, as an employer, someone who hires security testers and security analysts, I'm more interested to know, you know, what do you know how to do? You know, we can get you training, we can get you certifications. If they're needed. But I think those certifications have become kind of an easy button for recruiters to say, okay, I'm looking for people with these certifications. But when you get down to the hiring manager level, they really want to know what you're able to do. And so the education's good. You certainly need to understand the fundamentals, the grammar of cybersecurity, but you also have to have some of those hands-on skills. And those can be hard to get, at least in the testing arena. If you're thinking, well, I need to go hack somebody to you know, build my skills. No, that's probably a really bad idea. It could end your career very quickly. So
before it starts, yeah.
Think about how you're going to get those hands-on skills. There's online tutorials, whether it's Try Hack Me or Hack the Box or, you know, OWASP Juice Shop. There's a lot of virtualized environments that you can, you know, practice your skills on and defeat different challenges and level up your skills so that you have some of those hands-on skills that employers are looking for. The other thing I would say is that there's this whole realm of bug bounties that you can participate in. And those are not easy challenges. You know, large companies are paying a lot of money for bug bounty programs to bring them security flaws to fix. And a lot of those companies or applications that are part of the bug bounty program, they've been picked over pretty well. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're out there competing in that bug bounty market and having some level of success, that speaks really well to you having the right skills to get hired. So I would say, you know, it's the education, it's the skills. And then the third thing that I always tell people is network. You've got to, even if you have the best skills out there, no one knows about your great skills as you sit in your little bat cave. Mm-hmm. You got to get out there and talk to people, find out who's hiring, find out how other people got jobs, and let them know what you're able to do for them.
Yeah, I always recommend folks volunteer at like the B-sides or whatever local events they have just to like get out in the real world and show that you're there to help. You know, I feel like having that kind of attitude is so great.
Yeah, yeah. It, you know, try to help other people. There's always someone who's a little bit, you know, newer to the path than you are. Help them along the way. And you learn by teaching other people.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're coming to the end here. I'm going to ask the last question for you. It's the one I ask of everybody that comes on the show. It can be as wide or as narrow as you want. Do you have any predictions for the future of cybersecurity?
Oh, wow. I'm probably the worst predictor of the future ever. You know, some of my great failures in the past were I predicted that HD DVD would win out over Blu-ray. I wasn't old enough, but I probably would have picked Betamax.
Betamax.
So, you know, I would say predictions for the future. You know, when I first got into cybersecurity some many years ago, I went to a talk at Black Hat that was titled "Pen Testing's Dead," and I was really sad because I'm like learned like really basic efficiency in pen testing, and now it's already dead. So I would say that. You know, I would say the future of cybersecurity is very strong as AI and automation make attackers more effective. I don't know that we're necessarily going to need a commensurate, corresponding amount of additional cyber defenders, but we're going to need a corresponding amount of cyber defense capabilities. So, mm-hmm. I would say we're going to see cyber crime continue to increase. You look at like the FBI cybercrime losses, the graph, it just keeps going up. And I would like to think that, you know, we're going to have maybe in 2030, we're going to see a drop. I just don't think so. I think as long as there's money to be had and increasingly people from anywhere in the world or anywhere in the universe maybe can somehow get their hands on that money, that's going to be very attractive. And So my prediction, and probably sounds self-serving, but maybe I'm just realistic, is I think you're going to see cybercrime losses continue to go up. And if we get a handle on ransomware and business email compromise, which are kind of the two big gorillas on the block, someone's going to invent some new way to get the money. And I think that's my prediction for the future. As a consumer, you know, audit everything, log everything, watch those transactions, report fraud, sleep at night, and work with banks who will make you whole if you suffer fraud.
Awesome. Awesome, Terry. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation. I think there's a lot of value for folks looking to get into penetration testing here. So appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Take care, sir. And that brings us to the end of another great conversation. You can support our show by sharing your favorite episode with a friend, subscribe, give us a rating, or leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.